practical level. And even if we don't have the idea, the philosophical idea, it's something which we aspire to. But I will attempt to give you an interpretation of this. And that is that what the Torah is teaching us, it blasphemes, it curses. What he is doing is he is taking away from man the ability to rise to the true understanding of the holy name of God. And that's why he's punishable. He's punishable because he's doing a crime, not against God. He's doing a crime against man. In other words, of course, it is against the format is against the deity, and it shows he has no relationship with God. But it's more than that. It's really a crime to other people as well, because it prevents them, when people are influenced by such individuals, an individual like that who has such a distorted idea of God, his friends, his children. What he is doing is he's taking away, he's robbing these people of the ability to aspire and to be guided towards a knowledge of that most important thing, which is an understanding of the true name of God, as mentioned before. And that's why it is such a serious offense. It is so serious that even if he doesn't mention that name, and he doesn't disgrace that name directly, but even if he does it indirectly, he is also culpable. But he's culpable because of the fact that he's detracting from people reach understanding, the true understanding of the name of God. And that is really what everyone's goal should be. Because every human being's goal should be to gain the greatest knowledge possible of God, and that's a lifetime's work. Everything we do, when we study Torah, whatever we study, we approach a little closer. We get a little closer to understanding and to reaching our highest potential for understanding God. So that's the whole purpose of human existence, and this person is destroying that capacity in others. And that's why the Torah formulates it precisely in that way, that it is the name of God that's being disgraced, the holy name of God that's being disgraced. Okay, at any rate, I think we've really concluded, with this, we've concluded the main ideas in the in this part of the Talmud that deals with the concept of the violation of the curse of God, and the only thing left would be that just to give the final halachic decision, and the final halachic decision is that let me just 1 second. Let's see, my money is over here. Just give me 1 second. But with regard to what the final analysis, if a Ben Noach performs that violation, is he in violation only if he uses the name of God, or even if he uses a reference as well? And since the Talmud is mentioning this opinion, and there's another opinion, so then the question is, what is the final decision on this matter from a practical standpoint? And Maimonides gives the verdict in Laws of Kings, Chapter 9, Law 3. He states as follows: A Ben Noach that blesses God, as you know, we use the word bless many times, you know, because they don't want to say the word curse. Blesses God, whether he blesses him with the specific name, which is the YHWH name, or whether he blesses him in any way whatsoever, any reference in any language, then he's considered in violation. He says, as opposed to the case of a Ben Israel. So here we have a distinction in the final halacha, a distinction between the Ben Noach and between the Ben Israel. In this case, the Ben Noach is more severe. Sometimes it's the other way around, but in this case, the Ben Noach is severe. And the question, of course, is why? And this, I believe, has to do with what we mentioned a while ago, namely that the seven laws of Noah, the penalty involved is, you see, the seven laws of Noah are the most basic, the rudimentary concepts and commandments necessary for human existence. Therefore, even if the violation is done by way of innuendo, it also can't be tolerated. In other words, when you have a system, when God gave the system of the basic seven, this is the minimum possible. And therefore, in that minimum, the law of the Torah, the violation of cursing God, is not just in its most severe form, most serious form, serious structure, but even a reference to that idea is not tolerable on the Ben Noach level. Whereas with a system of 613, since it's a different kind of a system, so then the only time the death penalty is given is if the person actually uses the name of God. Otherwise, he's subject to corporal punishment, stripes, but not the death penalty. See, here again we see the difference in philosophy between the two systems. That the Ben Noach system, in this case, is more severe. Not always. In this case, in terms of, I'll give you an example. Where the Ben Noach and Ben Israel use the real name, then the Ben Israel will be more severe, because the death penalty that the Ben Israel receives is a more severe one. But in the case where the name was not used and the real name of God was not employed, then the Ben Noach's situation is more serious, because in those seven laws you cannot tolerate any kind of concept of a curse of God. There's another thing also that question over here. You know, I don't see my mommy is very good on that. But you don't need, according to one view in the Talmud, if the Ben Noach, even though he didn't use God's name twice, if you remember that question. So according to one view in the Talmud, if the Ben Noach did not use God's name twice, just once, he didn't use him as the initiator of the curse, only as the recipient of the curse, he would also be culpable, which is not true in the Ben Israel. Again, for the same reason, that when you get down to the minimum, so then it must be more strict. There can't be any reference even to the concept of the curse. So in both systems, it's a violation. But in the Ben Noach system, it simply forms part of the system. Once it forms part of the system, there must be a total commitment to that system, and any violation is of the most serious order. Okay, I think that if we've concluded the law of the this one of the seven laws with regard to this Talmudic, the area of the Talmud that explains it. There's something else that I will take up, and that is that we mentioned before that the Ben Noach, the penalty, when the court imposes the penalty, it's always the one with the death by the sword. Now, there is a question that the interpreters raise, and that is, you have a case in the Torah, in the Bible itself, which says the contrary, and that's in Genesis 38. Of course, in Genesis 38, we read the story of Judah and Tamar, if you remember, and over there it states that when Judah thought that, so he said, bring her and let her be burnt. Genesis 38, verse 24. All right, and it states that it was after 3 months. And then it was related to Judah that Tamar, his daughter-in-law, had illicit relations, and she was pregnant. So Judah said, bring her forth and let her be burnt. Now, the question is, we know that Ben Noach only has one form of the death penalty. All right, the Ben Israel has four. Ben Noach only has one of those four, and that is death through the sword, which is the only one that the Ben Noach has. And over here, the commentaries raise a serious question before the giving of Torah. And why should it be that the death penalty here was burning? Burning is not the proper death penalty. As a matter of fact, burning over here wouldn't even be the proper death penalty for the Ben Israel. But the Ben Israel wasn't burning at the stake. The burning was really where hot lead was poured down through the person's mouth. It was not a burning at the stake. It was a different kind of burning, internal burning. Now, so this death penalty really doesn't fit into any system. That's the question that was raised there. Now, there are two answers given to this question. One answer is given by the Tosafists. What they say is as follows. They say that there is a law in the in the Talmud for the Ben Israel. And that law states that the Sanhedrin, in times of lawlessness, have a right to impose penalties. They are more severe. In other words, if the Sanhedrin sees that society is becoming corrupt, they're becoming promiscuous, and people are losing their way, they have a right to impose more severe penalties than the Torah prescribes. But they can't. It can only be done in such a situation. It cannot be done on a permanent basis. You can't change any of the law. But they have a right at times to be more severe. So the Tosafists maintain that that was the situation in this case. That it was a generation that were really promiscuous, and it was a generation that weren't keeping the seven laws, and that Judah said that she should be made capable of in order to stop others from acting in a similar manner as she did. Okay, that's the Tosafist answer. There is one problem, however, with the Tosafist answer, and that is the problem that actually, according to the law of the seven laws of Noah, she really did not sin, strictly speaking, because she wasn't married, if you remember the story. She had lost two husbands, and she was waiting for the third. That was the custom in those days, that the brother would marry the deceased wife if the brother didn't have, if there were no children from the marriage. So she was actually in a time of limbo, so to speak. She was between the death of her second husband, and the youngest one, Shelah, had not grown enough to marry her. So really, she wasn't a married woman. Now, there's no, according to the laws of Noah, there's no violation if she lives with somebody. She really, even if it was a stranger, she didn't commit any real offense. The only offense is if there's a real marriage there, but she wasn't really betrothed to anybody. So that's according to the Tosafists. Of course, the Tosafists would probably answer to that. That it's true. While it may be true that there was no real technical violation, but still it was a promiscuous act. And again, the court has a right to even come down on people who are involved in promiscuity. But that is a questionable point. I mean, it is something to think about. I'm just giving you their interpretation. I'm leaving that one open to you. Okay. Nachmanides gives a different interpretation altogether. He states as follows. He says that Judah was a leader among those people. And actually, you know, if you have a group of people, it does seem that way from the Bible. It sounds like he was commanding them what to do, telling them what to do. So apparently when he left his brothers, he created this society. He must have been a very impressive man, and he went to this society, and then they raised him to the status of a leader, of a monarch, a king, and they listened to what he said. Now, what Nachmanides states is that over here, the violation was not a sex violation. That wasn't really what she was being brought to trial for. There is another halacha, and it's very interesting to Nachmanides. You see, in the Torah system, let me go to Torah system first. In the Torah system, there are two controls over the people. One is the Sanhedrin. They're the ones that study, they're the scholars. They study the law, they know the law, they interpret the law, and they execute the law. Now, there's another source of power and control, and that is the king. All right? Now, these two live side by side, even though there is a division in terms of what each one does. Okay, I mentioned the ones before. The king judges not according, he doesn't need to follow the strict laws of the Sanhedrin. Like, for instance, he doesn't need two witnesses. He could judge according to the way he understands it, according to his intelligence, according to his mind. So the king, and that's the same thing with the king Messiah, will judge, as it mentions in Isaiah 11, will judge according to his knowledge and his intellect. So the king is not restricted by the laws of the laws that the Sanhedrin is restricted by. So there are these two systems. That's why, for instance, if you remember how the two women came to Solomon, all right, there were the two prostitutes came to Solomon. Anyone, in contrast to Esther, by Esther you see Achashverosh, anyone that came to the courtyard of the king and the king didn't extend his scepter would be put to death. But the king of Israel has to be accessible to anyone, even two prostitutes. They have a problem, they have to have access to the king, and the king can judge. Okay, so the king has a right to judge as well. Now, there is another thing, which is if someone disgraces the king, so then the king can impose a death penalty. So what the Nachmanides states is that what she did was she disgraced Judah because of her actions, because of her promiscuity was a disgrace to Judah. So the reason why she was deserving of the death penalty, according to Nachmanides, was not because of the fact that she actually just did a simple violation, which was a violation of the seven laws of being a married woman living with somebody else, because she wasn't in fact married. But it was in her position, it was a disgrace. What she did was a disgrace because of the it was a disgrace to Judah, okay, who was the monarch. And the disgrace to Judah would be something which would reflect upon his whole position, and it would really seriously compromise his ability to impress the people with an ethical way of life. So that's why her, according to Nachmanides, her death penalty was really because it was an action against the king more than the fact that it was simply a violation of one of the seven laws. With this concept, Nachmanides removes the problem that we mentioned, both problems really, that the king, he says, is not bound by the laws in terms of which death penalty to choose. And also, even though she wasn't married, but to be promiscuous, and actually she was the daughter of Shame, if you remember, okay, of Melchizedek. So the
Rabbi, yeah. We got a question here from Launch Ledger.
Yes, Lawrence.
Rabbi.
Yes.
Going back to that story, she had already had two sons.
No, she didn't have any children.
I mean, two husbands of the sons of Judah.
Right.
Okay, and a third one was too young at the time of the death of the second one.
Right.
But yet he was promised. Mm-hmm. Under the custom that the younger brother should go in and raise up seed to the older brother, mm-hmm. or one brother. However it's recorded. Okay, now, the younger brother, even though he wasn't married, had a commitment to that woman, the way I was told, according to the custom of the day.
Right.
And he reached an age and was not given. Mm-hmm. And therefore, Judah caused disgrace to her by not honoring her under that agreement. Okay, so he actually faced her first, and then she did not disgrace him, but disguised herself and took the father, which would not permit the younger son, but took the father of the younger son as the bearer of her children, her child, whatever. And then you can argue the disgrace, you know, to Judah by her by disguising herself, of course. But actually, Judah disgraced her first by not honoring her, according to the custom. Now, that's what I was told.
Yes, you are correct. And it is true that Judah refused to give the younger son to her. And it says the reason is stated, because he said, and that is in 38:11, he says because he was afraid lest he do so like his brothers. So apparently he was, when he saw that the two brothers died, he assumed that it had something to do with the marriage, and that somehow or other, since he was so young, that she might be causing him to sin. And he was suspicious that she may have caused those other two sons to sin in some way. And he was very young, and he thought that until he's really learned, he should not permit her to marry him. So therefore, he was trying to protect his son. Now, he, it turns out, was wrong, but it still was apparently a legitimate kind of thing. In other words, you may criticize him or you may not. It doesn't say that he committed a sin to that. So he should have known that she was righteous or whatever, or he could say, well, he was entitled to be suspicious. And if he had reason, it doesn't say what the suspicion were in the Torah, but the Torah doesn't tell us everything, and it's quite possible that he had some kind of suspicion, suspicious grounds. It doesn't say what it was. He was wrong, but here he was trying to protect his only son that remained, and it doesn't say that he would never allow him to marry her. He was perhaps waiting till he reached the level where he felt that if she's causing him to sin, he'll be old enough to be able to withstand whatever it is. But what happened was, the story really tells us that she was righteous, and in fact, Judah, when he saw that she was right, he himself suffered the embarrassment, and he admitted that he had that he was the one that that lived with her, and this was really the way it worked out. It worked out in the way that she was truly vindicated. But we're speaking about the part of the story before she was vindicated. In other words, before that, in verse 24, Judah actually thought that she had wrongfully lived with someone else. And in fact, she did the right thing. She was really a righteous person. And she wanted to have a seed from Judah because she really wanted to produce individuals that would be God-fearing individuals. And she wanted to have children from Judah or from his offspring. So she was really motivated by a very high motivation. But if he didn't notice, and he thought she was just a prostitute. So at that point, the question is, even if she did prostitute herself, still, why was she deserving of the death penalty? And there you have two answers, as I said before. Either because even though prostitution is not deserving of the death penalty, in certain instances, the Torah states that even a minor violation can be treated seriously in order to raise people to a higher level if you're dealing with a society that's corrupt and that's depraved. So that's one reason. The other one was Nachmanides' reason, where he states that this, at that point, Judah thought that she was doing something which would completely compromise his leadership, and therefore she was deserving of death because she shouldn't have done such a thing to disgrace her leadership. So these are the two answers. But, in fact, you are right. The truth of the matter is that she was virtuous, and she was exonerated, because as soon as Judah realized what the truth was, he admitted it openly. As a matter of fact, if you take a look, you'll see that she was a very righteous woman, because she didn't disclose. It says, if you take a look at verse 25, it says, she was being brought out. It means she was being brought out to be killed. And it says, and she sent a message to her father-in-law saying that to the one who owns these things, he's the one that impregnated me. And that was Judah. But you'll notice, and then it says, and Judah recognized, she said that she is more virtuous than me. So you see, she wouldn't embarrass him openly. That's where the Talmud says it's better for a person to throw himself into a burning fire than to embarrass another person, because she wouldn't say it openly. She sent it to him privately. And then he admitted, and he was an honest person, a great leader, and he admitted that he was wrong, and he stated it openly, that she was greater than, and he suffered the embarrassment at the time. He didn't know who she was. So you see greatness on both their parts. But originally, Judah was suspicious of her. Could be that he mistreated her. As I said, that's something which I can't say. I mean, it's something to think about, whether he was right or wrong in what he did, due to his suspicions and the fact that his two sons had died, and he's trying to save the third one. But even if we assume it was wrong, it wasn't the kind of wrong that would be punishable by death or anything like that. It wasn't the kind of wrong that she was thought to have committed. She didn't actually commit, but at that point she was thought to have committed prostitution, when by doing that she was disgracing her leader. So that's, even though... Judah's violation may have been a, you know, he may have done something wrong, but it wasn't as serious a violation as what she did, or what she thought, what people thought she did at that point. Of course, later it was revealed that she was really just a woman, and she hadn't done any such thing. But at that, we were discussing the point before she was exonerated. At that point, she would have done a terrible thing, were that true. Whereas what Judah did, you may criticize Judah, and he may have done the wrong thing, but it was you know, there's different types of wrong. He had a justification, he had suspicion, he saw two of his sons died, he was motivated to try to save the last son, and he was trying to get him to reach a high level where even if she was causing her husband to be not virtuous, that he would be impenetrable, and he she wouldn't be able to cause him to sin. So he'd be impervious to sin. So that's what he was aiming at, which may be wrong, but it's a wrong of a different color. It's a different kind of a violation.
Rabbi, you got 1 minute.
Any questions?
Any questions? Nothing else.
Okay, I really don't have. Let me just think a second. I really don't have.
Just a moment, Rabbi.
Okay.
We had a question here. Was she Shem's daughter?
Yes, the rabbis say she was Shem's daughter. Yes.
Okay.
And that's why it says that. Okay, now the fact that she was Shem's daughter, that's why they, according to the Tosafists, the reason why they use the more serious punishment of burning is because the Torah does say in Leviticus that if the daughter of a priest who is married. Again, you have to know how to read the Bible. If you don't read it properly, you can make a serious error. But it says, in Leviticus, it states that if the daughter of a Kohen commits adultery, that she's put to death through a serious penalty, which is the burning. So that's why the Tosafists say that's the reason why that penalty was used, because of the priest. It says because she disgraces the house of her father, so it's more serious. So she, too, being the daughter of Shem, her promiscuity was an embarrassment, was a shame to the father, to the house of the father, who was a priest, which was Shem. And that's why the more serious penalty was imposed. So that's with regard to the question that was raised, was she the daughter of Shem? That's the way the Tosafists explain it. Okay, I guess we'll stop here. There are some more questions. Any other questions?
No, I don't think so. It'd be a good place to stop for tonight.